And I do think we are stupidly obsessed with how women look and we need to stop being. But I also think you can enjoy the way you look and you can enjoy boosting the way you look without being completely screwed up.
The conversation I've just had is one that's made me feel proud to be a woman of the age that I am, born in the 70s and growing up in the 80s and 90s. Because I was speaking to Polly Vernon. You'll know her from her interviews with everyone from Donald Trump to Harry Styles and her books and her writing for The Times and Grazia. And the one thing I thought when speaking to her is that just, I don't know, she's so fearless. And then after I spoke to her a little bit more, I just thought she's a fearless feminist and she's rewriting, I suppose, I don't know, sisterhood rules. And I'm really interested in that because she sort of has gone where many of us don't. And she speaks and writes beautifully. And she's so articulate about the things, I don't know, most of us might just think and never dare say. And I think that takes guts. But it's made me think, don't we need these people in the world, the ones who, I don't know, speak their truths or challenges the status quo, and maybe someone who makes us a little bit braver to say what we think? And that's certainly what I've taken away. I think my conversation with Polly is going to really resonate with you, and I think it's going to give you a dollop of courage. Enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. I'm excited for our chat today, Polly. Welcome to Conversations of Inspiration.
Thank you so much for asking me. I'm so delighted to be here.
I'm so excited by this conversation because I know we're going to get into stuff.
We are.
I feel like I'm sitting down with the original cool girl.
Aww.
And literally I speak for honestly, and your work as a journalist, you've interviewed pretty much everyone from Donald Trump to Harry Styles.
I have, yep. Yeah.
And I've also read that you describe yourself as a writer, a Londoner, and an older sister.
Yeah.
When you say older sister, yeah. I know you are an older sister, but do you feel like you're an older sister to women, just generally?
Yeah, I think I probably do on some level. I mean, I think when you're an older sister, it really defines you and defines how you see people around you, and particularly women, because I'm an older sister to two girls, particularly women. But I think I definitely felt when I started writing a sense of responsibility. I think I wanted to be the voice I'd needed when I was young.
Right, okay.
So I think I want to do that for other women. Yeah.
Other women.
And for young me, for little me.
For little you, which we'll get to at the end of this podcast.
Which we will, yeah.
A little bit extra, you also adore a French exit.
I do.
You're the survivor of several attempts of cancellation.
I am.
And you say that you're a thoroughly imperfect, atypical feminist, which welcome. I can't wait to get stuck in. We're recording this in September. I'm wondering, are you a lover or a loather of this moment in the year? Are you someone that's like bitching about sort of the summer's over, the heating's got to go on, you know, gosh, it's cold? Or are you sort of a fresh start, let's get going type person?
Basically, I love summer. I love summer with every bone in my body, and I love the spring, and I loathe winter. Autumn would be brilliant if it weren't that it's followed by winter, because autumn's beautiful, right? Light's beautiful,
yes.
Trees are beautiful. I love it from a fashion perspective because you mix it up. You're kind of 50-50, legs out, boots on, all of that.
Yeah.
I absolutely love that. It's so creative. I even really like raincoats. Raincoats are my new big passion. But the prospect of December, January, February, those months without any light, it's a lack of light that just, it drains me.
Right.
So a bit of a mix. But I do also, I am, you know, I can't resist the new pencil case allure, you know, things are changing and that's fine. So
that's fun. And it's also a good time for walking. Are you still an avid walker? Because 25 to 30,000 steps a day.
That was me. Do you know what? I'm much less of an avid walker for two reasons. One, I got into proper physical exercise. So what was hilarious about me, I got seriously into just walking everywhere in my 30s. And I thought I wasn't an exercise person. I was completely in denial about these miles and miles and miles I'd walk every day. But I sort of thought there was something noble and creative and rightly about that, I think. But actually, it turns out I just really love physical exercise. I love Pilates. I love boxing. I love weights. Like, you know, I'm just a jock. So I got much more into proper physical exercise in my 40s. And then I got a dog. And my dog doesn't like to walk as much as I do.
Rita.
Yeah, Rita is, she's just down here.
Oh, is she there?
Yeah. Well, maybe we can, yeah.
Yeah, have a conversation with her in a minute.
Maybe we could chat to her later. You know, she's used to doing podcasts and shoots and stuff. So yeah, so I walk less. I still walk a good 10,000 steps a day.
Right.
But I have less time with Rita and Pilates and boxing and stuff.
Oh, right. So you actually just liked exercise. You didn't quite realise.
What I didn't realise was absolutely that. I love exercise, but I had it so in my sense myself that I was not a fitness person. I was not an exercise person. I think I sort of kidded myself I was a little bit too clever. But in fact, I just had massive insecurities about it. I thought I wasn't terribly good about it, terribly good at it. Turns out I'm quite good. I love it. I love it.
Oh, how good to find that.
I know.
That is a good thing to start loving, by the way.
Isn't it?
Rather than just your new addiction to cake.
Yeah. Oh, so true.
Like, it's really quite annoying that you just sort of discovered that and started really loving something incredibly good for you.
Like, just unbelievably good. Not only that, but I started loving it at the precise point in my life that I really needed it.
It is. It's making me slightly sick.
I'm so sorry. I understand. You're right.
It is a bit annoying, but we'll forgive you because we're going to start with your story. On this podcast, we go back to your sort of younger self.
Yeah.
And you grew up in quite a feminist household. You were the eldest of your sisters. And I was when researching you that your mum wasn't wild about housework, which I just think is a lovely line.
It wasn't her thing.
And that your dad told you to turn off Miss World when he found you watching it because he thought it was sexist.
He says he didn't say that. And in retrospect, it could have been my uncle. But it was some man in my family who definitely gave me that message when I was watching The Pretty Ladies and The Pretty Dresses, and they were like, no, that turn off that sexist crap.
Right.
And yeah, he says it wasn't. I'm sure it was him, but it could have been my Uncle Ebba as well. So I don't know. But it was one or other of them. Either way.
Yeah. Either way, that's a good thing. You were one of three sisters growing up in Devon, and you were a curious kid. You said you had bad hair, that you weren't popular. Tell me what your childhood was like then.
I didn't love being a kid. My childhood was not unhappy in any way, but I just think I am one of those people who much prefers being an adult. And definitely as I got older, you know, even into teenage, I was like, no, this is it. This is where I should be. And I was talking to, I've got some twin sisters live just around the corner from me. And they were saying that, like, 16 now. And when they were about 14, they were like, oh, we hate school, but everyone's saying it's the best time of our lives. I'm like, it's not. It's absolutely not. Being an adult is the best time of your life. Brilliant. You've got money and, you know, agency. So I didn't love it. I didn't have that carefree running around doing anything I want. I think I always felt like a bit of an outsider.
Why do you think that is?
I wasn't born in Devon. So my parents moved me, I think I was about two or three, I was young, from Brighton. And apparently one of the earlier things I said, where are all the shops and people?
Mm.
So I think there was something in me that I felt that I came from a, you know, a bigger, louder, more stimulating environment. And I also felt self-conscious, and I didn't have a Devon accent, though I faked one for quite a long time. And it still comes out when I'm drunk. So maybe I do have a Devon accent. I don't know. I didn't really feel like I fitted in. But then I think that's a bit of a writer's perspective as well. You know, you're always watching, you're always observing, you're always wondering what's going on with other people. And when you're little, you're presumably assuming they don't like you.
Mm.
And I didn't feel popular, although I went home, my mum died about 10 years ago, and I went back for the funeral. And it was really interesting because, you know, it was a very small community. So it's a place called Topsham, just outside of Exeter, a town, but tiny. Super, super, super pretty, but it wasn't at that time at all gentrified. It was quite poor. And I met someone I had been at primary school with, middle school with, tiny little local school. And he was like, I always wanted to be your friend because you were one of the cool kids. And I'm like, I wasn't. So it's sort of really interesting how what your perception was and what other people's perception was.
Yes, what other people's...
Definitely was. I don't feel like I was one of the... I think at best, I was middling.
Okay.
And I became cool. You say I'm a cool girl. I wanted that so badly. And, you know, as I became an older teenager, I went to university, I was like, right, I'm having that. I mean, this is a complete confection. This is not natural. This is not effortless cool.
not effortless cool. I know what you mean.
I don't
not born cool.
Absolutely
not. Yeah, wouldn't you like to be born cool?
I don't know if anyone is.
No, you're right, actually. Maybe, but yeah, there you go. You at school, though, what was actually the sort of academic sort of side like for you? Did you have areas that you were passionate about? On this podcast, some guests pinpoint teachers that have made such a difference in their life. Was there someone for you? I know maybe not your English teacher because they repeatedly gave you a C for your creative writing.
That was in my secondary school. That was at comprehensive. So I was really mediocre and nobody ever went, she's brilliant, she's going to go far, like at all. But I just always wrote. Like I got a book of poems that my mother insisted I wrote when I was four, which she typed out with just hilarious spelling. And I can remember that. I can remember wanting to go home at the end of a school day and write stuff down because it felt brilliant. Mm. But I assumed everybody did that. I didn't think I was at all unusual. I thought that's just what we all did. We're all sort of beetling off home to write short stories and poems at seven. But, you know, I don't think, I mean, I was in a sweet but very average sequence of state schools. And I don't think anyone was, you know, they were concerned with getting us through and getting us out. But I don't think they were looking for a talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I was that spectacular. I was very good at languages. I love languages, but I just think that's, you know, that's liking words. It's just loving words.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
I think it is a bit.
So school wasn't, again, your sort of, your earlier life then was the sort of middle. You were middling in everything.
I was definitely middling. I was middling in everything. Popular. I mean, I think I felt very not popular at all until I went at secondary school. I came into myself a bit. I was a bit like, oh yeah, boys, right, gotcha. And, you know, became sort of kind of gave in to my sillier, funnier side. I was always quite, you know, I was probably one of the funny ones in classes.
Yeah.
So, you know, learned that I could make people laugh. Kept the writing thing under wraps because I think I might have realized other people didn't do that and that wasn't going to fly well. But, you know, just got through, had a nicer and nicer time as I became an older teenager, just got sort of better friends and loved knocking about and just being silly, really.
You were talking a bit, and I can already sort of tell that you're one of those people that maybe buck trends as well in sort of a good way. And maybe a little like we all did, because growing up and becoming teenagers in the 80s, as I did, I think we had this sort of, I was really reflecting, and it was from things that you've written about, but this sort of sense of empowerment that we didn't recognise at the time. You know, I was saying to my mum the other day, the school run was me singing Like a Virgin at the top of my lungs with absolutely no idea what the hell I was singing,
but it was fun.
Wearing lace gloves and doing this whole, do you know, really, like, really loved the lace gloves. And our mums were really the first generation of women to be able to open bank accounts in their own names.
So true.
We had Madonna, we had Margaret Thatcher.
We had Judith Prance, Julie Cooper. Yes. You know, that was how I learned about sex.
Yeah.
That from those books, thank God.
Yeah.
I think that was incredibly important. Just, I say I was somewhat raised by Madonna, and I mean that. Like, how unbelievably lucky were we? We didn't understand that she was sex positive or what sex positive meant.
No.
But we understood that she was powerful. We understood that men did what she wanted and not the other way around. We understood that she was remaking things and that she was making her own rules. And that was really cool. And I think wherever you stood on Thatcher's politics, and I certainly came from quite a left-wing household, growing up, seeing a woman in that position, it didn't occur to you that a woman couldn't be in the most powerful seat in the land because you saw it. That was entirely your experience.
Yeah.
So I think those were incredibly important things.
Yeah, and I've really not reflected on that until getting ready for this podcast, and just even that, just that sense that we really did have that as our environment. Yeah. And it was an amazing time. If we're going into sort of now your late teens, there's always seemed to be two narratives, that as a woman, we can be strong and courageous and empowered like Madonna, but that we should also be wary and cautious and sort of vulnerable as well.
Yeah.
Because we are vulnerable.
We are vulnerable, yeah.
And I know that you were a victim of a terrible, violent sexual assault when you were just 18, walking home, 6 p.m.
Yeah.
What, if you wouldn't mind telling me about that, but what was the experience like? And has it, because it's 30 years on now, how's that shaped you? And sort of what do you think is the way you were treated then to what you see now? I don't know if you have a viewpoint on this.
I mean, I think I did grow up feeling like a powerful woman. I think I really, really did. And I think that was partly, I think I had a sort of, you know, my mother wasn't into housework and she was into writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I, one of my paternal grandmother was kind of really politically active. So I think they were all difficult women, amazing women, but difficult women. But I think between them and Madonna and Ginny Cooper and Margaret Thatcher, that's quite a marvellous way to be brought up. So you never know how you will respond to being attacked. So I'd left home to go to university at that point. It was my first Easter break back from university. And where I grew up, there were a lot of pubs. There are pubs everywhere. And this was a particularly amazing one. I won't name it because that doesn't seem fair. But it was on a canal and you walked along the canal to get there. And I'd walked along and met one of my old friends from sixth form and had this really lovely afternoon. I wasn't drinking because I didn't have enough money. And I wasn't really into booze at that point. That came later. So I was, I think I had enough money for a Diet Coke and we shared some chips. And it was Easter, so March. It got dark quite early, but it was about six, and I didn't even think twice about it. I walked, started walking back. We said goodbye. He went the other way along this canal. I had to walk back. I think it was about 10-15 minutes along a canal. But it's really, I can feel my breath catching, even though it happened such a long time ago. To the main road where I could pick up a bus to go back to the town that I lived in. This was sort of halfway in between that town, Topsham and Exeter. And so I was walking along, do-do-do-do-do. This guy comes towards me, walk past me, wolf whistles me. I don't think anything. I was like, yeah, whatever. I carried on walking and then suddenly I felt myself grabbed from behind. And I assumed it was my friend because nobody else grabs you from behind, right? So I assumed it was my, even though it wasn't particularly his style. So, and then I got turned around and suddenly I'm looking at someone and it's not somebody I know. It's this guy from before who'd wolf whistled me. And it's so shocking that, you know, being touched like that by somebody who you don't know and you shouldn't, that every part of you, every part of your nervous system, every part of your brain is going, this is so wrong. This is so wrong and it is going so wrong. And then the next thing I knew, he'd sort of slipped his legs between my legs, tripped me up. I was lying on the ground. He was on top of me. And someone, you know, classic, someone was screaming. And after a bit, I realised it was me. And he put his hand over, he kept putting his hand over my mouth. And I can remember looking up at the moon. I can see the moon through the trees. And just thinking how surreal, how bizarre. And he said, I'll only take my hand away if you stop screaming. So I was like, okay. And then he said, which would you prefer, rape or murder? So I was down there. And I remember thinking, it might be a bit stupid because I can swim. Like, I can't, you know, you're sort of assessing. And I can remember thinking, he's probably quite thick. But also being, you know, who says that to you? And then he said, are you a virgin? Because I like it better that way. And it's kind of amazing. I can remember it so clearly, or maybe not. It's horrific. And I also remember getting unbelievably angry. Like, how dare you? And I started talking and I was like, I was like, my name is Polly Elizabeth Bernard. I don't have used my middle name anymore. And you, how dare you do this to me? How dare you have no idea who I am. You have no idea who you're messing with. Absolutely not. I mean, I was an undergraduate in French at Sussex University. Barely. And he, after a bit, he went, okay, who are you? And I went, my dad's chief of police and he's going to send his helicopter to get you. And this guy believed, my dad's an antique furniture restorer. And this guy, and I could see that he slightly believed me. So again, I was like, would you sort of, you know, I think in telling him my name, something new, that the more I humanize myself to him, the harder this might be. And then at some point, and I was fighting and fighting, you know, he was trying to get my clothes off and it was quite cold. So I had quite a lot of clothes on, usefully. And I was just sort of scrabbling and scrabbling. And at one point I got away and I sort of got up and started running and he got me again and pulled me down again. And that's, I remember thinking, oof, and I do remember thinking, if I just let this happen, it's going to be over quicker and I can get away. But then he just got up and ran off. And I think, apparently the more clothes you have on, physically, the harder it is. And if you're fighting, there's something like a bigger chance you'll get hurt, but equally a bigger chance that you won't get raped.
Mm.
But also there were a couple of joggers at the far side, kind of running along the main road that I was heading towards. So that was pretty shit. And I remember walking up to the, sort of scrabbling up to the road and just, you know, it had all gone so quickly, but seemed so mm-hmm. slow. And I stopped the joggers. I can also remember thinking, my mom's going to go mental, and slightly thinking, if I don't say anything, this is going to be, I totally, totally understand why people don't say anything, because you just think that's going to be such a fuss, and can I be arsed with this fuss? But I think I was so visibly, obviously upset that the joggers didn't really give me a chance, and I just said, look, I've just been attacked. And they took me to this nearby house and they called the police. And I remember calling my mum and going, look, I'm fine, but... And the police were, it's blurry from then on, but the police, I think, were lovely.
Mm.
They caught the guy because the canal path only really came out at one place, and some woman had seen some guy hiding in her back garden, and he was convicted, but it wasn't a custodial sentence. He had to pay me 500 quid, which he paid in £5 check increments, so like every 2 weeks. I was like, oh, here's another £5 reminder of a really unpleasant thing that happened to you.
And how has that experience shaped you, or did it?
Yes and no. I think I remember that in the police report, it said the victim fought her attacker off and that the police had said I'd really done a good job of scratching him up. And I felt brilliant. I think I felt brilliant about that. I never like thinking of myself as a victim or even a survivor. I am, because that was something that happened to me. Lots of brilliant things have happened to me as well. That was a thing that happened to me. I am proud that I got through it. But to this day, I don't like people walking too close to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
After dark. But does anyone? I don't know. Does anyone? And I was definitely, and this again, this could be older sister, I don't know, but I have never, ever, ever become so drunk that I couldn't get myself home. You know, I've always been ultimately quite sensible about being out. So I love drinking much less these days, but, you know, loved going out, loved having a lovely time, was always, you know, there's a certain point where I'm like, it's really dark. And in the days before I had enough money to get a cab home, it's like, right, okay, it's time to go now. This is what time your bus leaves. This is where you are. This is who you need to get home with you. So meticulous and sensible about getting myself home and looking after myself. So that's possibly...
Yeah.
A consequence, and I could have probably done with being a few degrees less kind of
controlled.
You know, less controlled.
Less controlled.
I might have had I've had a lot of fun, so I can't really.
Yeah, but. Well, we're going to go into happier times, but thank you for sharing that with me.
Not at all.
Thank you for going there, and just, you know, I'm very sorry that that happened to you. We're going to go to happier times, because after studying at the University of Sussex, you moved to London and you initially working in a cocktail bar in Covent Garden before leaving to take a job in fashion PR and becoming a junior writer on Minx magazine, which I hadn't thought about again until speaking to you. It was the time of the Spice Girls, Cool Britannia, New Labour. It was before the internet, which, you know, my son can't actually cope with, but and I remember speaking to Bryony Gordon, who I know is a friend of yours, and your early career and how it sounded a little bit like the sort of real life Bridget Jones. And I'm imagining you as Carrie Bradshaw in the early days of Sex and the City. Am I right? Is this going along the
Not
same?
Not at all, but I'll have that.
Oh, you'll have that.
I mean, I think it was brilliant. I think what is hard to imagine now is how powerful magazines and newspapers were at that time.
I used to work at Condé Nast, actually. I was at Condé Nasty.
You were Condé Nasty, then you know.
Yes.
And it was sort of, to be part of it was amazing. Like somebody said somewhere, the magazines were the internet. Like
yeah,
if you didn't have magazines, you didn't know what was going on. You didn't know.
Yeah.
So you didn't know what people, you know, didn't know what people were supposed to be wearing. You didn't know what they were supposed to be eating and drinking and going out and clubbing and what music they were supposed to be listening to. So it was so, you had such a lot of influence and such a lot of power. Mm. And that was brilliant. When you're 23, brilliant. but how fun. You know, I could not believe that somebody was paying me to write. So this thing I had done from childhood on that I loved so much, I was now doing it as a job, and honestly still that's my that's where I come in at mainly, like,
yes,
holy shit, this is extraordinary. And it was a beautiful time. That was a brilliant time. It was so fun and so potent, and things were changing, and having fun and being glamorous were the things.
Yeah.
And they were things I'd always wanted. You know, that was those, and being popular, all those things that I felt denied as a kid that I had always wanted, being cool. And I suddenly felt like I had them. Brilliant.
Yeah.
It was just stupidly good fun. And also, we felt that we didn't have much money. Of course, we were starting out. But I think you felt a bit loaded because I was talking to another friend about this recently, another journalist. I think at that point in time, because things were flourishing again after a recession, you know, financially, economically, things were flourishing. Things seemed to be hopeful after, you know, years and years and years of Tory government. We had this incredible Labour government, as it seemed at that time. So I think we thought we'd always have loads of money. We'd always have just a little bit more money than we did the year before. Mm. Like that would, you know, you'd always kind of be okay. So we used to go to the Atlantic and the Met Bar on a Tuesday night and drink champagne and get a cab home because,
yeah,
you know, you felt like you got enough money. You felt like there would always be enough money. So that was really fun.
Yeah.
And yeah, above and beyond everything else, I was doing this thing I had dreamed of doing my entire life. And I was good at it. People were telling me I remember my first ever features editor, who sadly died, but whom I have so much love for, David Spedding. And I remember, like, my first week maybe writing something, kind of tentatively showing it to him and going, this is really funny, you're really funny. And, like, I mean, imagine, you know, not only have I got my dream job, people are beginning to tell me I'm good at it. And that was so beautiful.
One of the things I'm most proud of at Holly & Co. is the fact that we're run by women, made by women, but open to all. Over 95% of the small businesses that sell on our marketplace are female-founded, and over 97% of our team is female, which means that every time you shop with us, you are voting with your money for the kind of world you want to live in. And by supporting women-owned businesses, you're backing the idea of flexible working, showing the next generation what's possible, and actively championing the female economy. It means that despite only 2 pence of every pound's worth of funding in the UK going to women, and women still being the primary caregivers, we are rising above and finding a new way to live life our way. You can support female-founded businesses by looking out for the badges on our website. In fact, we have lots of ways to shop by your values, from choosing black-owned businesses or socially positive businesses to products that are made of recycled material or crafted here in the UK. If you care about where you shop, discover more at holly.co. For now, though, let's get back to our conversation of inspiration. Before my publishing days, I was at Publicis Advertising Agency. So I was an ad land. And I think you had the same experiences. There were just these days where my boss at the time would, there was this place around the corner from Baker Street called Hardee's. And we would go at one, and it would just be for, you know, lunch, because obviously you'd have to have lunch out every day. And then the rosé got bought, the one bottle, but that would be normal working day. And then it was when I knew she ordered the second bottle of rosé, I was like, we're here for the whole afternoon. Mm-hmm. And we would just spend the whole afternoon out. And do you know what I mean?
It's amazing, isn't it, to think about it now? But yes.
And I would be smoking my fags. I was a silk cut girl at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be smoking my fags in the office, in the lift, in the cabs, in the...
smoking in the lift.
I was smoking in the lift. I'd go up to go and brief someone upstairs in the creative department. I'd light a fag before I got in the lift. What? Who does that?
But and yet it's really hard not to miss that, isn't it? I mean, not the smoking, but no. It was so fun.
It was.
I mean,
so
I know it was
fun.
Desperately problematic and politically incorrect, but it was so. I remember laughing all the time. It was so, like, everything was had so much money that not everyone, but organisations had so much money that they were fully staffed up. So we used to hold our magazine, used to go for lunch together, and we'd go to the pub because we'd all be like, oh, we've got days. Let's go to the pub and get drunk and spend the rest of the afternoon. And it was.
It was a moment in time. It was a moment in time.
It was. I'm so glad we had that. I miss it. I mean, I couldn't keep up with it.
No, of course. My gosh. The thought of drinking in the day.
Oh,
I mean, my sister's quite a nice. She likes to have a glass if we're, you know, in the weekend. She would think that's a nice thing to do. I have absolute PTSD, I think, over that because I can't even. Can't look at it in the daytime. Mm. There's no way that I'm lasting for a second as daytime drinking.
I mean, it's fine if I can go to bed at 4:30, but in the afternoon. Like, let me make that very clear.
Yeah.
I'll have a drink at lunchtime if I can have. An afternoon nap that slides into bedtime.
Yes, exactly. There's no refreshing nap after a drink, I don't think.
No.
So I'm going back to who you've interviewed here because it's some of the world's most famous people. I mentioned in the intro, Harry Styles, Gwyneth Paltrow, Donald Trump at Trump Tower. And he showed you how he styled his hair.
Yes, he did.
Now, this was an experience like no other because this was 2011 before he'd been declaring himself as the candidate for the Republicans. But how the hell did you bag that interview to start with? And what was it like?
Okay, I should probably come out at this point in time and say I don't set up my own interviews because I'm like, that is a really complicated dance and it's way beyond me.
Right.
All I do, so there are people attached to the magazines and newspapers I work for. They set up the interviews, so they get the talent, so all credit to them. And they then start suggesting writers. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people go, absolutely not, that woman is coming nowhere near my precious talent. And sometimes they're like, all right. And who knows? I don't know. I think I must have done enough kind of big Hollywood stars who hadn't entirely hated me at that point. And also Donald Trump was at a different point in his trajectory.
Yes.
So when I got there, he was definitely considering running for the Republican nomination. Mm-hmm. And I got there and I say this in the piece, there are T-shirts all over the place that say Trump 2012. But kind, you know, I really don't know if they were left there purposefully for me to see or not, because I don't think they were that together at that point, Team Trump, at all. Trump Tower was obviously the lobby is what it is, disgusting, but very impressive. But upstairs is really ramshackle and crap. And, you know, it's just like people wandering around with fluff on their cardigans. And, you know, I expect to be overwhelmed with glamour. I was not. And then Trump turns up. And he's massive. But second, he's not at all charismatic, which I expected. You know, I expected to be blown away by the charisma, but I wasn't. And we went into his office. I had pictures of him all over the wall. So I began, you know, you're looking around you the whole time for clues.
Yeah.
And I began to think, this might be a man who likes the look of himself. And I wasn't really getting anywhere because you spend the whole time kind of, it's a bit like you're unpicking a lock on, you know, you're kind of like, this is, if I say this, if I say this, if I say this, I wasn't really getting anywhere. And I kind of, he referred to all these pictures of him on magazine covers all around the wall. And I was like, it's interesting, isn't it? Because how do you think you stay so relevant? And like, honestly, at the time I was thinking, how do you dare? Because no one who isn't a toddler isn't going to go, oh, fuck off, you're trying it on. Like, you know, you're blowing smoke up my ass, so I'll give you something. Him lit up like a firework. Suddenly like, that's such a good word for me. Relevant is such a good word for me. And I remember thinking, my God. But then I spoke to somebody else who knew somebody else who had had a similar experience. And he is just so extraordinarily open to flattery. It is like giving a child sweets. It's just like, yeah, more of that, more of that, more of that. Tell me how great I am. And I don't think that's much of a secret. But yeah, then he was a bit vague and a bit waffly. And I just thought it'd be funny to ask him how he does his hair. And yeah, he showed me step-by-step guide. Like, he was like, and then I brush it this way, and then I brush it that way, and then I hold the hairdryer like this. And I was like, oh, come on, this is gold. And it does kind of make that interview. I mean, I didn't know. It's one of those things. It's always a thing, the case with interviewees. It depends when you interview them. I didn't know he was going to become the most powerful and contentious man in the world at that point. And he was, you know, a few years off that. But yeah, it's really odd in retrospect, thinking,
wow,
I was in a room with that man. But he, you know, he didn't. I've had worse interviews. I have had interviews I have liked less, strangely. But, you know, nor was he, he didn't have all the things that you'd expect. You know, he didn't have that kind of magic X factor that you could later go, oh, yeah, that's why.
Right.
So that's how you pulled all this off. So
interesting.
Yeah, I'm as clueless as everyone else, really.
What a moment. What a thing to say. I mean, unbelievable. I mean, your career went from strength to strength, and you became an interviewer, a columnist, a features writer, and everything from Vogue to The Guardian. And of course, you just sort of don't hold back. And the fact that you were very open that you didn't want to have children. And I read when researching you that you knew this, and I was so surprised by this, at the age of 7. And yet it seems to have been a statement that either one can't accept or it causes uproar still.
Yeah.
And you've been writing about this for years. Why do you think choosing to be childless by choice is polarizing?
I think we are so incredibly attached to the idea that that is fundamentally what women are for, whatever else we say. I think there is the legitimate, entirely understandable and marvellous, extraordinary love that women feel for their kids. Not always, but generally, right? So I think that is in the mix, and that is true, and that is brilliant. And I would never take that away from anyone. But I think there is also just, I think we are uncomfortable, really uncomfortable with the idea that women don't want that for themselves, because then what are we? And then it's really, I think it's a bit risky for society. And I think, you know, I sort of look around now, and we do have rapidly falling fertility rates or birth rates. So women are increasingly
not having children.
Coming onto my team, not having children. And I, you know, I see that can cause massive issues societally. But yeah, for me, it was just, I just remember being 7, I think, and a neighbour coming around, and she just discovered she was pregnant, and everyone being so excited, and me kind of thinking, that's what you want. And then coming around later with her newborn baby and saying, do you want to hold it? Me going, you're all right. Looks like it's going to be sick. So I, you know, I had no kind of real sense of compulsion. I think that troubles people, because that is unnatural. And not what we understand women to be about, whatever we say. And then as I got older, so it was sort of a visceral feeling of, no, that's not for me. And as I got older and started expressing it, people were like, no, you'll change your mind, you'll fall in love, you'll change your mind, blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, I can remember someone saying, well, no, by all means, have a little career and then see, you know. And then I got older and older, and I kept saying it, because there is something definite in me. However shy and unsure and whatever I was as a kid, there was also something in me that just was like, no, I'm going to say this because I think it might cause some trouble. But also because it's true, right?
Mm.
Yeah, people were always a bit surprised. And then, so you know, I started at Minx and then somehow found my way into newspapers, which I loved. And while I was at The Observer, I wrote this column. I think I wrote it for Minx actually when I was about 25, 26. For the first time, I just don't want kids. And it didn't cause anything like the bother it did, but that was still pre-internet and pre-comment, so that's probably why. And then I remember writing it for The Guardian, we just sat on The Guardian's website, it's for The Observer, and I remember watching the comments. And I learned quite early on that you just don't look at the comments.
Mm.
And that was probably one of the first and last times I did. But there were so many. I mean, some people were like, yay, but most people were angry or derisive or said I'd changed my mind. People on Mumsnet had just launched, people on Mumsnet were very, very, very angry with me. But then I also remember getting letters, like handwritten letters through the mail from women in their 70s and 80s saying, yeah, we were like you, but we couldn't say anything at the time. But, you know, we carried on with it anyway. And we're so happy you're so right, which so sort of heartwarming and brilliant. And yet, and I sort of, you know, I've revisited it over the years because I think Instagram, particularly social media, has sort of, reinvested in this idea of women as mothers and this kind of performance of motherhood and this performance of pregnancy, and look at me with my beautiful children and look how perfect my life is, even though they pretend that they're showing you the crappy side as well. Like, it's very much like, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. Look, here I am, such a nurturing person. Actually, that's really cruel. I think there is a massive negative comparison thing around it, which is causing a lot of pain. But I genuinely forgot to write about it for quite a long time because I was happy. I was so happy with that decision. It was so right for me. And people kept going, we regret it. You're going to wake up one day and go, oh, no, it's too late. I've made an awful mistake. And I didn't. But I forgot to say, you know, I forgot to say that because I was living this life I really wanted to be living. And it was brilliant. And it continued to be brilliant. But then I met a woman. So I have a dog. She sleeps by my side at the moment. And that brings you into a sort of community of dog walkers. And I met a woman with just a gorgeous golden doodle, golden retriever poodle mix puppy. And I was, you know, we were chatting about how gorgeous her puppy was. And she was like, the problem is, she was like in her mid-30s, I think. Problem is, it makes me not want to have children more. And I was like, well, is that a problem? And she looked at me and she was so grateful. And she was like, you don't think it's a problem? I was like, no, of course I don't think it's a problem. That's my choice. And she was like, everyone around me is telling me I regret it. She's married. I just don't want it. And I was like, yeah, that was exactly what I felt. And she went, and you don't regret it? And I was like, no, my life is brilliant. You know, no, of course I don't. And she couldn't stop asking me for reassurance.
When you're talking, I'm thinking, what gave you this? Is it the big sister where we started this conversation, the big sister element within you? Because I'm wondering, how did you gain the confidence to tell people what you think? Because I'm just thinking, potentially some, myself, wanted to fit in. You know, wanted to fit in, didn't want to cause a stir, et cetera, et cetera. Not about children, but just generally, I wouldn't just voice my views. Do you think it's the fact that you were a journalist, you were in this sort of world, and that has allowed you to voice opinions that others hold back, and thus then actually position you in a place where actually women sort of quite like that you're the first one out? You know, you'll say it. We won't say it, but you'll say it for us. The big sister element. What do you think it is?
Do you know what? I think it's Madonna again. I mean, I think I grew up thinking a woman who was so herself and so nothing we'd ever seen before was so brilliant. So I think definitely that I was wanting to get into journalism, obsessed by Julie Birchall's columns in the Guardian Saturday magazine. And she was so like, I'm just going to tell you what I think. And I sort of, and I definitely, when I started writing, I mean, I started writing in the mid, professionally for magazines, in the late 1990s, I suppose. And there was that culture of Spice Girl kind of bravado. And you were supposed to say stuff that was slightly shocking. So there was all that, on top of which I have always, always felt, what the hell is the point otherwise? And I am not doing this to genuinely shock. I still don't understand. If an opinion is out there already, widely shared and widely accepted, what's the point of me reiterating it, right? The only point of me writing at all, writing opinions, is to put stuff out there that is a bit new and a bit fresh, but is truthful. Like, I am not a controversialist. I'm not interested in winding people up. I am only interested in saying things if I think they are truthful and useful, helpful. So there's always been that in me. And I have always felt that sharing, you know, from seeing those initial responses, I understood that it was really important to go, yeah, you cannot have kids. And I think as I got older, I didn't want people going, oh no, poor thing, she couldn't have kids.
Yeah.
And I also think, and I have come to understand so many more things, like, for example, it's really important for women who do want kids and can't have kids to see a woman without children be really happy, like be really just entirely fulfilled. That's important. So it's grown. My understanding of it has grown. My understanding of why it's important to talk about it has grown. And it's definitely something that has fed that bravado because it works, right? People respond to it. They like it and it's important to them.
Yeah.
So of course I'm going to carry on.
Well, it's, you know, it's really, really refreshing. And I'm coming back to your story because in 2015, you released your book, Hot Feminist. Ugh. And I think it's fair to say that you anticipated it might be a bit contentious. Mm. And this was because the book covered the relationship between fashion and feminism. You wrote about your life, mm-hmm. your assault, mm-hmm. abortion, mm-hmm. your feelings on motherhood, which we've just covered, and what it means to be a woman. And I think the thing is, you write with this fearless honesty, and sometimes they're not ready for a level of truth. People aren't ready for a level of truth. I want to ask you about this book, actually, and what happened. Yeah. But also, you know, I go fast forward to now. And when we talk about people being scared to say what they think, we are now living in a world that I'm even scared to say what I think about that entire thing. You know, it's incredibly difficult. But going to this book, Hot Feminist, mm-hmm. you might have known it might have been inflammatory, or did you not? Did you think it's just integral to who you are and that's fine what anyone else thought? But what did you think before it came out?
I mean, I never really do think about a potential response when I'm writing something. I just think this is what I think is probably true. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, that book is a whole sort of conversation. What was actually happening? And again, I realise it now much more clearly, is I could smell that incoming wave of sort of demand for compliance in the way we think and feel. Mm-hmm. I could smell the shame that would be poured on me. I could see it beginning. Mm-hmm. There weren't words like cancellation or internet pylon. None of those existed at that
or
point.
Or trolling.
But I could sit or troll it anyway. I could see that people who were not saying the right thing about anything were having a hard time. And I knew, as somebody who historically didn't always say the right thing or said stuff first, said stuff early, that that could be a problem for me. And I could see it was particularly happening with feminism. And I just thought, that's not okay. You can't say in the name of supporting women, we're going to tell women what they can and can't say and think and feel. And I also felt that there was a sort of joylessness with it, a very dour, I think it was very victim-y and very poor me. Whereas my feeling about feminism is it should be more about how you help other women, right? It should be about the structural changes that you can support. Mm-hmm. One of the real strong arguments, I was like, I don't think, I mean, again, I'm probably passing myself off as far cleverer than I am, but it's in the book. It was the first time I wrote about my own experience of abortion, and I wrote personally about that. But I also was thinking, this is too good a thing to be true. Like, abortion rights, so easily given. That's a risk, because there are going to be people who aren't happy with that for long. And I was right. Mm. You know, but, you know, I was very much saying, stop hanging around worrying about whether or not that man is looking at you funny and focus, because this could be an issue. And I was, you know, I was bloody right, wasn't I? Mm. But people were very, very angry with me about that. Very, very angry that I was not singing from this one hymn sheet. And also that I was like, look, it is entirely possible to consider yourself a feminist and to find empowerment, again, probably Madonna, but to find empowerment in feeling sexy, in being sexy. You know, so there are all these things wrapped up in one. The other thing that happened was most people didn't read it. So the book came out. It was reviewed horribly by The Guardian, my former employees, The Guardian, very, very well by some other people. But I became, for a few weeks in the summer of 2015, I became just this thing that was hard to hate on. This woman, it was okay for you to call yourself a feminist and just say disgusting things about on the internet. That was my role. And it was horrible. I mean, it was
Yeah, I was going to ask, how did
horrible.
You cope with this?
I got quite depressed, really. I mean, you know, you've sort of written a book, and I went there in that book. I was really, really fearless in the writing of it. My family didn't know about the abortions I'd had. So I had to send, quite slightly difficult emails before it went out. They were all brilliant, I have to say, my family, and the abortions, actually. So, you know, I was really, really going there. I was really exposing myself. And I still think that was cruel. You know, what a cruel thing to do, to go, look, this woman's made herself vulnerable. Let's get the bitch. And they were all women. It was all other women. So the initial response to the book was actually quite lovely. It was serialised in the Times. But then there was this kind of intake of breath. And after about 3 or 4 days after it came out, I just started getting extraordinary stuff on Twitter, just horrific stuff. And it was sickening. And I had this thing, the writer Tanya Gold, who I think is brilliant, something similar happened to her about an article she wrote, a one-off article she wrote. And she said, you get to the point where you hate the shape of your name. Like you see the shape of your name online and you know it's followed by really damning, disgusting stuff and just kind of speculation about your character and who you are and the things you think and feel and things you believe. And it was awful. It was awful.
And when you said earlier in the interview, one of the last times you looked at comments, I'm assuming you were looking at these comments, though. These were the comments coming through.
So I learned within about a year, I think, of stuff going online on the internet. Because when I first was writing, there was no such thing. But that happened about 3 or 4 years into my career. I learned very quickly that you just don't look below the line. So you don't look at the comments. Because when you publish an article, what you're doing is you're establishing this niche little bit of the internet, this niche little part of social media that is entirely about hating you. So that's stupid, right? Don't you learn that very quickly. But when you've got a book out, you are, A, really encouraged by your publisher and you feel like you have to promote it.
Yes.
And that's social media is a very powerful tool. Instagram wasn't really, it was kind of there, but not really in the mix. Twitter was it. And people were entirely happy just adding, sending me this stuff relentlessly. And also, you get to a point where you are being not particularly healthy. And and I can remember getting up in the middle of the night and searching on my name to see what people were saying, even stuff they weren't adding at me. Mm. And it becomes like self-harm. You're compelled to do it. And you sort of kid yourself, I need to know so I can prepare myself. But it's so eroding. It's so painful. The shame is extraordinary. And I didn't get fully depressed, but I got as close to being, I'm not a depressive person, I got as close to it as I have ever been. I felt overwhelmed by anxiety. I began to get to the point, because you think when people are coming at you online all the time, your nervous system can't tell the difference between that and real life. So I remember being on the street and just sort of flinching and just thinking people were going to knife me.
Why do you think this happens? Well, I mean, this was 2015. So this is
it was an early case. I was a trial case.
Yes, a trial case. Was it because it was early? If you published this book, I mean, we're going to talk about your latest book, but if you published that book now, do you think you would have got the same response? Do you think we're now all a bit, do you know what I mean? Now we're sort of, we're 10 years on, so we can handle things better sort of now, or do you think?
I think we know a little bit better. I mean, the kind of people who were coming for me were nice women who considered themselves very feminist and, you know, decent human beings, but they felt it was within their gift to have a go at me. I was the one it was. I say in the book, actually, there were sort of safety valves on feminism. When there are women, it is okay to destroy in the name of your feminism. And I was one of them. But I think part of the reason people don't do it now is because of what happened to me then. You know, I wrote a lot extensively about what happened to it. And I know, I've had one apology, which I really treasure, actually. But I know other people feel bad about it in retrospect because they've told other people, who've told other people, who've told me. So I think I was part of a lesson.
Right.
And I think there's much greater understanding of what trolling does and that you can be a troll without being some anonymous man in a basement in some far-flung part of America. You know, you can just be some nice woman, perfectly nice woman, and say disgusting things. You can do that.
Yeah. And I just, how is that experience, did that dent your confidence at all in terms of, this confident, woman who I was just saying how brave you are. You say the things that some women just are like clapping you because and cheering you on because they can't say it, but you're going to say it for them. How did that make you feel?
I mean, what was truly awful, and I've said this before, being trolled like that is like those, you're immediately thrown back to those your worst days in school. When suddenly you don't know why, a rumour's gone around you about you and everybody hates you. And they're all saying you smell and that you fancy someone ridiculous. And it's like that. You are such an outcast, except you're an adult and it's the whole of the internet. It's awful. It's really, really awful. And what was particularly painful for me was this thing that had always been brilliant and like a refuge and, you know, and my career and all of it, which was writing, this such unbelievably precious thing was the source of this pain. That was awful. Like the one thing I had always felt like I could rely on when things had got difficult, which of course they had, was causing me pain. And that was terrifying. But I have to say, I have an amazing boss at the Times, Nicola. And she, oh God, I'm getting tearful. And she really recognised what was happening with me. Mm. Can't believe I'm doing this. And she knew instinctively, or I don't know, that the way to get me back on the horse would be to send me out an interview. So interviewing is something I love so much. And then what I was doing then was I was just employing the skill that I had honed. And it was nothing, it wasn't about me at all. It was about other people.
Yeah.
And oh, God bless her. I mean, she's a terrifying, amazing woman who is with a heart of gold. But, you know, she just gave me brilliant interview after brilliant interview after brilliant interview. And so I never got off the horse in terms of writing and publishing.
Yes.
You know, I was always, and I was doing really good work then as well. And then she also kind of got me to write when the paperback, the, I think, trade paperback it's called, of the book came out. She got me to write about the experience.
Mm.
And she handled it so well.
What an amazing woman.
She's just,
what an amazing woman. True sense of feminism, right? Backing other women and lifting them and seeing them through the bad times.
She has such such an incredible history on that, actually. She is brilliant. Thank you, Nicola. I do actually love you.
It reminds me of something I got this morning from a friend. And I'm going to read it to you because actually this lady sounds exactly like this quote. And it was about friendship. Be there for the messy parts of someone's life. Don't be afraid of the ugly. Hold someone's hand when no one else can or will. Pull them to stand. Be there for the dark moments and then enjoy the light together. Don't take a seat at the celebratory table if you won't be there to collect the shattered pieces when the same world falls apart. It's easy to get an invite to someone's pretty, someone's sparkle. But if you get an invite to someone's raw and real, show up and you have been blessed. Show up for the ugly. That's friendship.
Oof, that's lovely.
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah.
Show
yeah,
up
yeah,
for the ugly.
Really,
that just made yeah. me realise that that's exactly what she did for you.
Yeah, she really did.
I'm going to go now again. I keep taking you to darker places and then happier places. But,
that's
you know,
fine.
If that's okay, because right now we're saying it's taken you 10 years to write another book.
Yeah, it did.
I think because of that experience, but you did it. And How the Female Body Works, which I'm holding in my hands now,
mm-hmm.
was released in June this year.
Mm-hmm.
No trolling, I'm presuming.
No trolling. No trolling.
Because it's been called a joy to read, mm-hmm. wonderfully informative, funny, witty, engaging, and I could go on. And I love that you said technically we're close, my body and I. We go everywhere together. And yet, I know little about how it actually works.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about this book and why you thought that you were the right person to write it.
I just got to a point when I had too many questions to not start looking for some answers. So I think it was very much as of a function of a timing. I'd say it took me 10 years to write another book. And that was hugely part of what happened to me the first time. Because you're a bit like, it's so much work. Writing a book, as you know, is so much work. So if you do it, then sort of tentatively offer it to the world and the world goes, you're awful. You're not going to do that again. No hurry.
Yeah.
But the other thing was I hadn't got an idea that wouldn't leave me alone. And this was an idea that wouldn't leave me alone. And I'm not a health writer. I'm very like passionate about fitness, but that's a personal thing. And the main question that kept occurring to me was, what's a hormone?
Mm.
Really, what is a hormone? And then also, if they're so powerful, if they have such a big impact on our life, are we our hormones or, you know, do we have personalities? Do we have free will? Or are we just kind of on this sea of hormonal rushing? And then I kind of started looking at the environment we're in, and there is so much misinformation about health. You know, I'm bombarded with stuff I should be doing for my body every day on social media.
Yeah.
And it's really overwhelming and scary. And then I thought, why isn't there a book? You know, why isn't there something that sets it all out from somebody who doesn't know? You know, I wanted to take, the idea is that I take readers on with me, in with me, along with me, in this journey of asking a whole series of experts using all those interview skills I've got, the most basic questions. I mean, I ask a neuroscientist what a brain is. I ask a gynecologist what a vagina is. Mm-hmm. And as I acquire knowledge, they acquire knowledge. It's not, I didn't want it to be dry. I didn't want it to be boring. I wanted it to be fun and cool and kind of revelatory. And you know, one of the first things you learn as an interviewer is there is no such thing as a dumb question. Dumb questions are your most powerful ones because they make people really consider the answer. Mm-hmm. And then when I kind of thought, okay, this is what I could do, this will work, I started thinking, but surely it already exists. And it didn't.
It's time to talk about the benefits of using tracked postage. Our partners, Royal Mail, have a range of postage options to suit your needs. But when you want to ensure your customer's order arrives on time, tracked parcels are definitely worth a look. With Royal Mail Tracked 24 or Tracked 48, you get real-time tracking, delivery notifications, photo evidence upon delivery, and up to £150 in compensation, ensuring peace of mind so that you can focus on delighting your customers. There are different tracked options depending on if you're sending to customers here or abroad, including the option to have the parcel signed at the door. To learn more, check out royalmail.com. You say in the literature that came with the book, which I am not surprised as someone who for 20 years, you know, dealing with women and, you know, from my side of things in business and raising money and the patriarchy that we live in and everything. Until 1993, women were mostly excluded from medical trials. And even today, fewer than 4 in 10 participants are women.
Mm-hmm. Extraordinary. I was quite passionate originally that this wouldn't be a political book because I thought that sort of muddied the water. I wanted it to be really useful. Okay, I wanted it to give the information to be really useful. However, when you start digging into it a bit, it's very hard not to be political. I mean, I think one thing I would say is I found the whole experience of researching it really cheering because there are people who care so much and they're working so hard to make women's experience of their own bodies better and easier and more comfortable and less painful. They really, really are. Mm. We've come a long way, but the place we came from, and not that far away, 1993, it's extraordinary. We were considered, our hormones were considered to make us too complicated to be a study when you're like, or do they mean it's more important that we're studied?
Yeah. I don't know. Because potentially we're all quite reliant on this, aren't we?
A little bit.
The human race?
A little bit. A little bit reliant on the medicine.
Tiny bit that this thing works in a woman and maybe helping women keep their things working
would be good.
Might be top of the agenda.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think it's an amazing book. I've started it and it sits next to my bed. I'm one of those people that I can do about 2 or 3 pages a night. Are you a big reader?
I am, but I'm a big fiction reader, I think, because I tend to write nonfiction and journalism is nonfiction. I do love getting lost in a story. I love a bath. That's one thing I like about this time of year. It's bath time again.
Bath time.
You can't have a bath in the summer.
Yes.
So I will take a book into the bath so happily. Yeah.
Well, I have your book. I totally agree with you. There's so many things, isn't there, when you get stuck in, you can't quite believe what you're uncovering, which is basically what you've done in this book. You've uncovered the fact there wasn't sort of a book that just you sat down and learned. And how do we not all know about our bodies, which we don't?
No.
I wanted to talk to you about something else, which is within all of this, which is aging.
Yeah.
And you're someone who loves growing older. You call it magnificent. And I can just say that I completely agree. I keep telling everyone I'm 50 and then like, and everyone's like, but you're not. And I'm like, oh no, I know. And
but
like,
I will be.
But I will be.
Gonna be.
Quite sort of looking forward to it. And you wrote an interesting piece recently that tackled the area that you can have cosmetic treatments, you know, having work done whilst, you know, still being comfortable, basically aging, that those two things can coexist.
Yeah.
Do you think that there is a shift that we're seeing, that we're sort of entering maybe into a new phase? I mean, or do you think there's judgment?
Oh, there's definitely still judgment. I mean, I think it's, and this is the sort of attitude with which I came at the feminism for hot feminists as well. I think there is a lot of judgment And there is a lot of stigma. And I think there is an assumption that you cannot have work, which I have had much, and I intend to have much more. You cannot have work and be a good feminist or at all well-adjusted. I think the assumption is if you have work, it's because you are in denial about aging. I'm not. I love aging. It has
given
me
yourself.
So much. Or you hate yourself, or you, and you kind of want to self-mutilate, or you hate how you look. And that, I think one of the things that irritates people about me, there are many, but one of the things that irritates people about me is I talk about the work I have all the time, but I am lucky enough to have access through work to just the best people, so I don't look fake. And I think that really pisses people off. I think they want you to look ridiculous so they can go, there you go, yeah. Your vanity. And I think it's almost like kind of some fairy tale, you know, Grimm's fairy tale, vanity will be your downfall. You know, you're so stupid to worry about what you look like that you should just fade into insignificance and your vanity will kill you. And so here am I, still being massively outspoken, loving getting older and getting all the Botox. And that's distressing. You know, it's confusing for people. That's just a lot of different stories at the same time that they didn't think went together. And I do think we are stupidly obsessed with how women look and we need to stop being. But I also think you can enjoy the way you look and you can enjoy kind of boosting the way you look without being completely screwed up.
Yes.
You know, I think that's possible.
Sometimes it occurs to me that there is so much work that needs to be done. Like you were saying about feminism, but, you know, stop talking about someone maybe looking at you strangely. Let's try and change laws, for instance. You know, let's use our energy in the right way.
Yeah.
And it does make me wonder why, as women, we've traveled so far, we've gone through so much, why we don't even pick ourselves up and just say to ourselves, have each other's back. Whatever she wants to do, if she's happy, I'm just happy. But what we can do together is this, this, and this.
Yeah.
You know, these are her choices. And actually, isn't that the whole point of us being women, that we can show this grace and this empathy to the world that is crying out for it?
Yeah.
But we can then club together maybe on the things that do matter, because that's something that we do share views in. Because I look at, you know, these all Hollywood and this aging grace, amazing sort of, you know, now everyone in the last Oscars or something was, you know, everyone that won, I can't remember, you know, were older.
Was over, yeah.
Over whatever.
Yeah. There was a really good
It wasn't it? It was incredible to watch.
Yeah.
But what do you think these women are doing behind closed doors, everybody? I mean, it does make me go, God, aren't they amazing? They look 40 at the age of 80.
Yeah, how's that happened?
It's not the smoothie they've been drinking.
It's not. And I do think, so I do think, you know, I was kind of a bit confused about women's obligation to talk about the work they have. But actually, I've come down on the side of, no, you've got to talk about it. You've got to be honest about it. Because I think otherwise, you leave a lot of people comparing themselves with you negatively and going, but why? Why has she not got any lines? I tell you why I haven't got lines, I hear, because I get them syringed away once every 5-6 months. And I think it is hugely important that we are transparent. I think it's also really, really important that we see women aging without that stuff. You know, I would, without being one of them, not that generous, the more Sarah Jessica Parkers there are, the more that are going, no, I'm not going to do this stuff. Mm. And you look at me anyway.
Helen Mirren,
and
you know.
Exactly. And you see that I am beautiful because I am anyway. I think that's really important. I think while getting it all, I don't like the idea that every woman gets it all and that's all we see. However, I think it is important that if you do get it all, you are open about that. And you're like, this is not what a woman of my age would normally look like, would naturally look like.
Absolutely. I really agree with you. And I also love that you said that in social media, you will not filter your face.
No.
And, you know, and again, this is, again, all of our own choices on how we're going to navigate this period
ourselves.
Of time. You know, and if that it works for you, then that is your choice. But also at the same time, there are so many things that all of us women would share a view on, such as how the female body works needed to not have been coming out this year. It needed to have been written about yearly, right, for the last 20, 30, 100 years.
I do think, as I was writing it, so I write a lot, there's a big old chunk about the menstrual cycle, and there are so many things I didn't know.
What was your most shocking thing that you learned?
Okay, so you get drunk quicker when you're ovulating, and you are, and the impacts of alcohol and nicotine are more intense on your body when you're ovulating, basically because all your body cares about at that point in time is getting you pregnant. It doesn't give a damn about processing alcohol. Also because you've got higher testosterone in you at that point in time, which is going to make you indulge in riskier behavior because it wants you to get pregnant, wants you to have sex with absolutely anyone and get pregnant. So I'm like, well, that explains like most of my 20s. You know, there were times when I went out and was like, why am I sozzled on two glasses of wine? It was probably because I was ovulating. Equally, you're more disinhibited, so you're more likely to text someone you shouldn't. You're more likely to, if you are trying to give up smoking or trying to give up a dodgy ex, you're more likely to take up that poisonous behaviour again. So it's just stuff like that. I'm a bit like, oh, I could have really done with this in 1997.
Yeah. When that diary entry had that little marker that I was ovulating, I needed to just go home. I needed to not have one of those boozy lunches.
Have a drink of water, watch this live. Go to bed. But no, but so, you know, I think it, as I say, I wanted to produce a useful book. And I do think my experience of everyone who's read it said that what they tend to do is they read the instruction and they go straight to whichever section is most appropriate to them at that point in life. And then they go back.
Yes.
Because it's a bit like, you know, you need to read what happened to you in puberty. You need to know about that to understand where you got to now. I think it's like therapy, right? It's a bit like therapy with your body. You're like, oh, and you end up feeling really forgiving of a lot of the things you did, because yes, it kind of wasn't your fault. It was your, like, genetic programming.
Yes.
But also just having real respect and kind of awe for this contraption, your body, which is just trying its best for you all the time. It doesn't messes it up all the time, but it's really trying. It's like an incredibly loyal, adorable dog.
But it's an amazing thing that you've done. I mean, really, really. It sounds as though 2025 has been your year, because not only did you publish your book and maybe, I don't know, healed some wounds.
I did heal some wounds. I really did heal some wounds.
But you also launched Broad, your Substack, in May.
My Substack,
of this year.
No, it was May last year, actually. 2024.
May last year. Mm. And this is where you share a slice of life with us all.
Yeah.
Everything from fashion to your opinion pieces. What has that experience been like, to feel like you can be your rawest, most authentic self?
Been brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. It's when I was researching you in advance of this podcast, and you know, I have never thought of myself as entrepreneurial, which is, you know, which is what you embody, I think.
Yes.
But that, apart from when I launched this Substack, so Substack, for people who don't know, sorry if this is really patronising, is a subscriber newsletter. So you ask people to pay you a little bit, and then they get, in my case, two articles a week. But when I sat down, because I love journalism with all my heart. Print journalism is, you know, it's in my soul. It's gorgeous. But it's going through a difficult time, let's say. And I got to a point where I hadn't had a fee increase for a decade from anyone. So I was working. I couldn't have been more successful. Cover stories, left, right, and centre, award-winning columns. But I could see a time when that wasn't going to be enough money for me to live. I am not a person who is particularly driven by money, but I am a person who doesn't want to have to do anything else because I love this. Mm. So I decided to try Substack to see if it worked for me. And it has worked so well. But I did approach it, I think, in the most entrepreneurial way I ever have approached anything. I was like, okay, I know how to do this. This is me. This is my area. I am going to effectively build a sort of weekend newspaper supplement. But it's all me. You know, I'm going to give people stuff to buy. I'm going to give people emotional hits. I'm going to give people contentious opinions. I'm going to mean every word of it. But it's so fun. It's so, you know, it is, for a fairly rogue writer anyway, I am allowed to be, because it's just me, it's mine. I own
yes.
It. I am allowed to be more rogue than I would be anywhere else. Because I like kind of testing subjects from lots of different angles. And I can do that. You know, with a newspaper and a magazine column, you have to kind of focus in on your one argument, deliver it and go. Whereas this, I can go, yeah, but on the other hand, what? That, on the other hand, that. So that's
yes,
naughty, but also nuanced and really fun. I can write to whatever length I want, and I can then voice it so people don't have to read it. They can listen to it. I can use whatever pictures. I mean, the pictures of me that have been used in the press are, my byline pictures are generally, everyone's byline pictures, they're quite stern and dull, and I'm very serious, when in fact I'm quite a silly, smiley person. So I think people, and I think this is added to some bother in how I'm perceived, people assume you're a bit of a haughty cow, when in fact I'm a bit silly. So I can suddenly use pictures of me smiling and looking silly and goofy. So, you know, from that on, plus I've got this immaculate training from years of brilliant people. You know, I know how to write a headline. I know how to draw people in. I know just when to whack the paywall in. So it's been, and it's grown, and it's been brilliant. And the people who are subscribing are just amazing, and we're all chatting, and I love it. I absolutely love it.
Oh, I'm so pleased. I mean, would you say that you're happier now than you've been
ever
before?
Yes.
Ever?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just curious because I feel
definitely.
This might be, you know, it's an amazing thing, I think, again, getting older and just finding yourself and being more you than you've ever been. And that's what age gives you.
Absolutely.
Is this your sort of, when you think now to your time, is this the happiest you've ever been?
I mean, I really, really hope that I just get happier from here on in.
Yes.
But yeah, absolutely. I am more, I mean, people talk about the confidence women get when they're older. I don't like, it's like cocaine. You're like, oh my God, I'm amazing. Has anyone seen how incredible? I mean, you really are. I feel suffused by it. But at the same time, I don't have to prove anything to anyone. So that's a killer combination. Yeah. Sort of thinking, I'm really, really good at this.
Yeah.
And also, I don't care who, you know, as long as I have enough people paying me enough money that I can, you know, carry on doing this. That's it. That is what you want. I don't need to be the richest girl in the playground or the most famous writer. I just need enough people to enjoy what I do and pay me to do it and that I can carry on doing it. And that's it. So that's lovely. Yes, no, absolutely. And then, you know, the whole of the rest of my life has just fallen into place around that. And, you know, exercise has been a huge part of that.
Mm.
My dog has been a huge part of that. Not having children has been a huge part of that. You know, it's been a big old journey and it's been a lot of work. But yeah, I was right.
You were right. You were right. We're coming towards the end of this interview. And I ask everyone on this podcast, what would you say has been, if you are on a roller coaster, for, you know, go back to your younger self and this whole ride that you've been through from working lunches, less working, more fun,
more
singing
lunch
at the top of your lungs to through all of that you've told us. What would you say when that cart was at the lowest point of the roller coaster has been in your journey?
I think the lowest point in the roller coaster would definitely be the first book coming out, Hot Feminist, coming out, and just being told basically that I was a bad person and I was bad at this thing I loved beyond anything else, which is writing. That was unbelievably painful.
And conversely, with the wind in your hair?
I mean, the early stages were amazing and exciting and so, you know, I can still remember being offered my first job in a magazine and just how incredible, how just brilliantly incredible. And then again, discovering I was good at it. And I have won a few awards and that's obviously lovely. But no, honestly, I think it is just feeling like I am still getting better. That's really important. You know, it's really important to me that I never cruise, that I keep putting out kind of really, really good work, that I keep, you know, you asked me earlier if writing the first book and the pushback I got from that damaged my, you know, desire to be damaged my desire to say the things I really believe.
Mm.
And I think actually there was, after getting over that, I was like, I have nothing to lose anymore. There are so many people, writers and people with any profile, who are terrified about getting cancelled. I'm not. I am free of that because I know if you are really truthful and if you hold your nerve, in the end, people kind of go, oh, no, she was right. Shit.
Yeah. On to the next.
Exactly. I wish we could get over that. But you do become stronger because of that, and you become more inclined to put stuff you really believe. That I published something on my Substack about woke yesterday. So yesterday, and I was scared when I pressed the publish button. I was scared, but the response was brilliant. People respond so well to honesty, and authenticity, and you saying things that matter and that are useful. They do,
yeah.
So I will carry on doing that. So yeah, it's got to be now, hasn't it?
It's got to be now. It's got to be now.
This is a high. But I hope not the last one.
Well, no, not at all. And knowing you briefly, I can only imagine this is not going to be, you know, the happiest. There's more. There's more books. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you.
Me too.
I'm going to hand over to you. I know you have penned something to your younger self.
I have.
And it's, wow, to have your skill writing a letter to your younger self is a real privilege. So I hand over to you and thank you for everything that you've shared.
Thank you so much, Holly. It's been such a joy. Dear Polly, yes, it really is me. I know. Despite our stoned revelation about 1992 that time travel would never happen because if it could, someone would have already come back and told us. I can't explain the technology, no. But even if I could, we wouldn't understand. It's not really our area, is it? But look, first things first. You're brilliant and it all works out. That's the headline. It works out in ways you are not even daring to dream about. It is bigger and better and it feels more lovely than you can imagine. Although I'm going to retract that. Part of what makes you adorable is that you have such low ambitions for yourself. You're so incredibly easily pleased. Like how when we got that job in a cocktail bar in Covent Garden at 21 and spent 6 nights a week for 18 months in a lycra cat suit and Wonder Bra, serving Long Island iced teas to city boys and scraping by on minimum wage and tips. And still, we totally thought we'd made it. We didn't think life got more glamorous or thrilling. I'm equally loath to give you advice or guidance in retrospect because you, by love, you work it out. You struggle and you fall on your ass and you think it's never going to go right, but you work it out. And then you struggle and fall on your ass again and again. And still you go to wherever it is the two of us find ourselves today. Blimey, this is grammatically complex. Although also, it's not as if this is any kind of end point. You and I constantly feel like we're just getting started in it in the best, most potent way. Here are the things on which you can and should and will fall back on over and over. One, you're a grafter. You've only just discovered this in that job in a cocktail bar. To this point, you were a bit more floaty-coasty, but the realisation you can earn money by working hard has been quite the revelation. You have a considerable work ethic, a sense that most things can be solved by you rolling up your sleeves and working just a bit harder, and you're right. Number two, accept that, like so many of your generation, you believe if you work hard and are competent and nice, people will recognise, respect and reward it. They won't always. They'll get used to it, start taking it for granted. That will sting you from time to time. You'll feel like you've been overlooked, overtaken by a person who talked a better game, who picked themselves up to superiors, who preposterously took them at their word and how great they were, and ignored the evidence of your ability and graft in favour of their words. You don't have to play that game too. It's short-lived. The games are anyway. Suppose it comes fast. But you don't have to believe it when someone else starts acting and talking like they're better than you. They aren't. You're really good at working out who among the men is good for you, supporting, championing, loving, if we're talking romantic or friendship. You have a couple of bumpy goes, but work this out really early on. You're much, much less good at seeing who among the women is good for you. You'll get used and burned a lot by women simply because you sort of assume they're women, so they must be okay. You'll go above and beyond to help women who simply don't deserve it, who would never dream of helping you in the same way. Be more careful and wary. They're all telling you who they are in tiny ways all the time. Heed it. Equally, number four, you'll encounter women who lift you up like you're in the lyric of a Beyoncé song. Learning to tell the difference between those types of women can steam a lot of your adult life. It's hard at first, but you get there. You're entirely commendable, but not always that useful compulsion to help every single woman who asks for it gets focused on those who deserve it, which is where it should be. Five, you're absolutely right to think about how you dress as much as you do. It impresses people, as it should. It's an expression of your creativity and your wit. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Six, rejection is horrendous and inevitable. The most useful thing you'll come to understand about it is that everyone suffers it over and over, especially if they're doing anything good. It comes with the territory. You will never not feel its sting, but you'll get over that sting more quickly all the time. And you never let it stop you from trying things, even when it's stinging hard and long. That's a lovely thing. Seven, there's no such thing as a big break. There's no moment after which everything falls into place and flows. There are many triumphs you hardly even recognise along the way. Then suddenly there's this body of work of which you can be very proud. Eight, obviously you make mistakes. And while some of them sometimes seem monumental, you get over them all the time. None of them define you. Nine, being happy, being satisfied, being fulfilled are active states. You work towards them all the time. They don't drop in your lap. You don't just wake up like this. You make good choices over and over and over. And there you are, happy, satisfied, and fulfilled. Number 11, it's never about right. Money, that's not your driver. You need enough, but never loads. This means you'll generally have enough, but never loads. 12, it's a bit about ego. Seeing your name in print is never not a thrill. 13, but it's mainly about writing. That's what does it for you. Same as it always was. Same as it was when you were a 9-year-old kid writing stories on a piece of A4. It's always lovely. Number 14, you probably should have started a pension earlier. Number 15, stop trying to prove yourself to people who don't care and don't want to see how good you are. They never will, and they don't matter. I love you far more than you love yourself right now, but don't worry, that comes too. Lots of love, me, your older self.
Oh, you really are, going back to the beginning, this older sister. I was listening to you intently as you read that, and I just thought, we're lucky to have women like you who are courageous enough to voice your opinion, to be who you are. Some of us aren't, we just aren't that way. We're not inclined to do that, but we're not confident enough to do it. Mm. And we need women like you who are, and who have skill and talent to articulate it in the most beautiful way. And that was a stunning letter. Oh. And really, honestly, I'm enjoying your book. I'm enjoying meeting you. And I so look forward to what mischief you might come up with next. And you know what? I'm going to be right there cheering you on. So thank you, Polly, so much for being on this podcast. It's been an honour.
Oh, thank you. That means so much. Thank you, Polly. Huge love.
Thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams, to build a life they love.